In today's show, it is going to be about Gaza, but a little different. Instead of taking a look at today's news, we're going to step back a bit. And this is an interview with Norman Finkelstein by Middle East Eye. Middle East Eye is a reputable Middle East analytical organization. They are pro-Palestinian. Here they're interviewing Norman Finkelstein. And the interview goes on so long that we won't be able to provide the whole thing, but I think it's a very good overview of the situation right now that we have in the Middle East. So, Norman Finkelstein in an interview with Middle East Eye.
The problem is not that Israel is not obeying the laws of war. That's not the problem. The problem is Israel is obeying the logic of genocide. The Democratic Party legitimized the commission, the execution of genocide. Trump will build on that, but the Democratic Party created a foundation. When you're a believer, there is the transcendent cause, and then there are the mundane facts. The transcendent truth is Am Yisrael Chai. Israel lives.
Welcome to The Big Picture. My name is Mohammed Hassan, and it is my distinct pleasure to welcome back to the show Professor Norman Finkelstein, political analyst, author, and I want to say now friend of the show. Can I say that?
Sure.
Thank you very much for being here with us today.
Well, thank you for having me, and I hope we'll have a productive conversation at a very fraught moment.
Absolutely. We are speaking just a couple of days out from, well, after the election results, and it's still very fresh. There's a million takes on the internet, and everybody's trying to analyze the soul of America and what happened and why Trump not only returned to office, which was expected in some way, but with such a resounding, undeniable victory, and what feels like the complete collapse of not only the Democratic Party, but any kind of established left or center-left option here in the United States. And there are people that are quite hopeful. I've been spending the last couple of days talking to people about why they're voting for Trump, and there's a lot of cautious optimism about the fact that not only is he going to improve the economy, but he is going to stop the war in Gaza and Lebanon, and that he is going to do what the Biden administration failed or was unwilling to do over the last year. And of course, we have lived through a Trump presidency, and we understand the kind of chaos that descended upon the Middle East as a result of it. But I want to hear from you what you feel about why Trump won in the way that he did and how he convinced so many people that he is their answer to this, as you mentioned, a very fraught moment.
Well, we'll start from the end and work backwards towards the beginning. I don't think he convinced anyone of very much of anything. I don't think that's an accurate picture of what happened. There were only two alternatives. It wasn't like people had a slew of alternatives from which to choose. There were two. There was Kamala Harris, who represented more of the same, and she had no program. It was completely negative. It was just anti-Trump. In my conversations with people, and I do have, I would say, fairly extensive conversations, because each day I jog or walk along the seashore and I meet many people at Coney Island, and obviously the subject of the election comes up, came up. And there was only one person who had even a clue what Harris stood for.
Yeah.
He mentioned the homeowner $25,000 promise, and he mentioned the child credit. But he worked in politics. He was actually distributing leaflets for one of the candidates, so he had his talking points down. But otherwise, she was a completely empty show. She wasn't just a zero, she was a minus one. She had no track record on anything. It was quite a feat that Harris had been ridiculed for 4 years during the Biden presidency. And suddenly there was this phenomenon, which for those of us who go back a ways, and I do, it was very reminiscent of places like North Korea, where you have what was called at the time the great leader, Kim Il-sung. And then Kim Il-sung passes, and out of the shadows, the deepest, most, the innermost recesses of a cave, emerges his son, Kim Jong-il, I think was his name. And suddenly, the whole state apparatus orchestrates. We all feel joy at the announcement that Kim Jong-il will replace Kim Il-sung. And so you have these scenes of hysterical joyousness at the emergence of Kim Jong-il, a complete non-entity. Nobody had ever heard of him. And so when I started to hear about the joy of Kamala Harris being anointed, of course it reminded me of the old days of Kim Il-sung. Now his grandson is in power, and so soon will, well, his grandson is still young, but presumably will have the same joy at the fourth generation at some point. So I don't think people were particularly hopeful that Donald Trump is going to solve their problems. I remember talking to the owner of my local bakery, and when I asked her, I live in a, well, not all of it, but part of it is relatively liberal neighborhood. Part of it's just Trump across the board, conservative Jews. I live in an all-Jewish area, and the conservative Jews, forget. And they only like him because he's a racist. That's it. They don't care about anything else. She said, things can't go on like this. They can't go on like this. She didn't want to say, I asked her, so what do you think about the election? And she didn't want to say she's pro-Trump. It was a little bit of an embarrassment.
Nobody in New York wants to admit it. Yeah. But you talk to them long enough and it comes
right. So, but because things can't go on like this. And then she started to talk about overregulation of small businesses and prices going through the roof and we can't afford. And then everybody in the bakery, the other workers start to chime in. So the election of Trump was in part because Harris stood for absolutely nothing, just anti-Trump, scaremongering with the Trump Hitler, Trump fascism, that sort of stuff, the sort of stuff that people like AOC specialize in. And now she's saying if Kamala Harris's name was Tom Harris, she would have won. Oh yeah, it was all about misogyny. It was all about misogyny. You know, what is it, a quarter of the countries in the world have already had female heads of state? It's not as if this is an obstacle to high office. Our southern neighbor now, Mexico, has a female head of state. You know, no, Ms. AOC, it wasn't about misogyny. It was about people hurting, have continued to be hurt the last 4 years. And your normal, your instinctive reaction is, if you have a choice between more of the same and a roll of the dice, if you have a choice between more of the same and the same is intolerable, the same is intolerable, and a roll of the dice, well, rationally, you're going to choose the roll of the dice. Because the present is, as she said, it can't go on like this.
Yeah.
That if a real alternative had been presented, say if Bernie Sanders had run again on the same platform, Medicare for all, attacking big pharma, attacking corporate greed, talking about redistribution of wealth and so forth, I have no doubt he would have won. He would have won in 2020 if the Democratic Party elite didn't stop him in South Carolina. If you remember, up until South Carolina in 2020, the whole Democratic elite was hysterical that Bernie was going to win. And then for certain things, they came in for the fix and they knocked him out. But if he had presented a viable alternative, I think he would have won. So I don't think it was people's investment of hope in Trump. It was the fact that there were only two options. One was more of the same. The other was a roll of the dice. So rationally, if the present is intolerable, you choose roll of the dice.
Yeah. I wanted to read you on what you're saying, a quote from Harris's concession speech, in which she says towards the end, "I know many people feel like we are entering a dark time. For the benefit of us all, I hope that is not the case. But America, if it is, let us fill the sky with the light of a billion brilliant stars, the light of optimism, of faith, of truth, and service." And this feels like it echoes what the Democratic Party was trying to present during the campaign, or at least in the last 3 months, this idea of light versus darkness, of good versus evil, and of the idea that there is a darkness that is descending and has now descended in the shape of Trump. But it rings very hollow to me, this idea of describing what this year was for a lot of people as being the light, and what now we're entering a period of darkness. It feels like it's describing a reality that doesn't exist for almost everybody that was voting this week.
Well, her metaphor was perfect. Her metaphor was, look for light in the sky. People don't want light in the sky. They want light right down here. They want happiness and hope in their daily reality. And that wasn't on offer by the Biden administration or by Kamala Harris. It's not light in the sky. That's like there used to be, it's still around, it's an organization called Salvation Army. And the Salvation Army promised you hope in the hereafter. And Woody Guthrie, who was a famous folk singer, you won't know him because you're too young, but the song you might know of his was, "This land is your land, this land is my land from California." Yeah. In any case, so he had a song and it said, "There's pie in the sky when you die, that's a lie." And that was what she was offering. Pie in the sky, that's a lie. People want a pie here, and they have a right to a pie here. So if that's what's on offer, bring on Trump. Now, I think he will be a disaster. You know, he will be a disaster. No question about it. We have to reckon with that fact. And it was a factor to weigh in deciding how to proceed on election day. I think it's probable. Trump is basically a bully. That's his nature. He likes to bully little people while pretending to be standing up for little people. So he respects power. So I think probably he'll bring an end to the war in Ukraine. I think Mr. Zelensky sees the writing on the wall. They're going to pull the plug on that little venture because he respects Putin. Putin is power. I think probably they'll find a modus vivendi, which is the fancy Latin term for a way of living together, modus, method, vivendi, living, a modus vivendi with China, because he respects China. China is power. People who don't have power are in for a very hard time. That's why he kicks around immigrants. He's the kind of person who kicks them when they're down. He kicks them in the face. That's his nature. Gaza, no good. But even in Gaza, we have to remember the Democratic Party legitimized genocide. That's not a cliche. That's not a throwaway line. The Democratic Party legitimized the commission, the execution of genocide. So Trump will build on that, but the Democratic Party created the foundation. About that, there's no doubt. Also, the Trump policies, which the most egregious of his policies, let's say recognizing Jerusalem as the capital of Israel, Biden could have reversed that. He decided not to. Scrapping the nuclear arms deal, the nuclear power deal with Iran, Biden could have reversed that. He didn't. So the horrors will come. I'm aware of that. And I've never denied it. The horrors will come. On the other hand, and I think it isn't on the other hand, you have to balance. On balance, I don't think you should reward genocide. I don't believe you should reward genocide. There are about 17,000 children, minimum. I think it's probably much higher, but I can't prove it. A minimum of 17,000 children who were killed by President Biden, by the Democratic Party establishment. They killed them. There couldn't, Israel can't breathe one breath without the United States. It cannot. It's not a metaphor to say that. The weapons were pouring in every day from the U.S. Israel's a tiny country. Tiny country. They can't afford to carry out a war for a year. We bankrolled the whole thing. Biden and Harris, the Democratic Party, they enabled it. So I don't believe you should reward genocide. That should be, I believe, a red line. And secondly, it's a clearing of the air. Namely, this whole Democratic Party is completely bankrupt. And now there is a forceful reckoning with that fact. Now, it's also true, and we have to be clear-headed about it. People can draw completely reverse, completely opposite conclusions from the same experience. So some people are now saying the problem with the Democratic Party, it was too left. It has to be more centrist, okay? And other people are saying, obviously,
the opposite.
Right, it wasn't left enough. It didn't leave any, there was no grounds for the working people to vote for the Democratic Party. So it's not true to say that the fact that the Democratic Party is now bankrupt or has revealed its inner rot, it's not true to say that people are going to all draw the same lessons from it. But still, I think it's a positive thing that the rot has been brought to the surface. Otherwise, we would have had 8 years of Kamala Harris. Joy, more years of joy. So I think it's good that the rot has been revealed, but I'm not going to deny the Trump administration, the best one can hope for. You know, sometimes you ask yourself the question, when an institution has so much power, like our presidency, do you, and here I'm not being facetious, do you prefer competence or chaos? Trump, it's going to be chaos. Mm-hmm. It's going to be anarchy. Whoever, with that woman who was appointed chief of staff, I hope she, as we used to say, she keeps her day job, because she'll probably be out in 6 months. He'll be, you know, his favorite line is, you're fired.
Yeah.
So it'll be chaotic, right? But then sometimes you ask yourself the question, do you prefer chaos to the competence of Blinken? Blinken was very competent. Jake Sullivan was very competent. Do you prefer the competence to the chaos? Part of me prefers the chaos. It means that monstrous machine called the state is going to be, it will have diminished efficacy. That's probably not because I have an anarchist in me. There is an anarchist in me.
Of course, there's an anarchist in you.
No. Well, because any person of the left,
yeah,
whether it's the Marxist tradition or the anarchist tradition, has always believed that the states are concentrations of unjust power. That's what makes a state a state. So any person of the left worth his or her salt is going to support the dissolution of the state. But this isn't quite the dissolution. This is just the anarchy of a very eccentric individual.
It's the delusion of the state.
I'm not sure what's the right word, but...
But that reminds me of a moment in time, and I have heard a lot of people that mm-hmm. have said that I'm voting for Trump not because I think he's a good person, but because I think he's unpredictable. And in mm-hmm. that unpredictability, maybe he wakes up one morning and decides that he wants to free the Palestinians.
I know. Yeah, it's the throw of the dice.
Yeah.
But it's not going to happen.
Mm.
No, there is a certain predictability to Trump. He is contemptuous of people without power. He enjoys, he's a sadist. There's an element of sadism in him. Well, we all possess an element of sadism. That's the thing, you know. We all have our good angels and we have our very ugly demons. With Trump, there's no repression of the demonic side. Most people, in the name of civilization, they try to, you know, one of the cornerstones of civilization is trying to repress, trying to control the demons in us. They exist, and the mind is a very complex organ, and you can't stop demonic thoughts from passing through your head. That was all this idiocy, this complete ridiculousness of this cancel culture. If you know this term that was popularized, we're going to interrupt racism. Mm. Interrupt. That's what people like Robin DiAngelo. She was paid $10,000 by some corporate firm to go to the workers and interrupt racism. What does that mean?
Yeah.
Interrupt racism. You can't. It's like, it's literally an attempt at self-mind control.
Mm.
You can't interrupt thoughts passing through your head. That's not possible. What you can do is you can try to not give vent to them. You can try to, you know, rationally say to yourself, yes, that thought's passing through my head, but you know what? That's not a nice thing you're thinking.
Mm.
And you don't act on your demons. You can't control it, but obviously you don't have to act on it.
Or you could do the opposite, which is completely let everything out and be honest and transparent about all of your demonic intrusive thoughts, which is, in a way, what Trump has allowed people to do.
Yes, he has, but unfortunately, he has power, so he can act on it. That's why he enjoys kicking around illegal immigrants. You know, as a factual matter, I live in New York, okay? During the COVID years, our city would have been completely dysfunctional without the illegal immigrants. If you went to places like the supermarkets, the bodegas, it was all being, they were the only ones out there who were doing all the work.
Yeah, the halal carts on every corner. And
it was all the Mexican workers, and Mexican and from Central America. Mm. They were doing everything. And I think if you, it was Ralph Nader. I was listening to his post-election analysis, as always smart. Mm-hmm. Nader is top of the game. He's 90 years old. He's like Chomsky. His mind is as nimble as when he was 20.
Mm.
And he said, you could have just patiently said to the American people, well, remember, the immigrants are doing this, the immigrants are doing that, they're doing jobs that nobody else wants to do. They're very hardworking, which they are. You know, they're very hardworking.
Because they have to be there. They don't have a choice. There's no social safety net. There's no option.
That's correct, because they're here illegally. And believe it or not, I know this is going to sound like feeding anti-immigrant hysteria. If you go, like, on the Coney Island boardwalk, here's the mother, and here's the father, and there's an army of kids behind them. They're like, hey, kids. I think the Spanish word for army is ejército, ejército. I think there's an army of kids behind them, and on top of all that, they're living on subminimum wages, they are having large families, and they're sending half their paycheck home. Mm-hmm. How they manage it, only God knows, but you know, my hat's off to them. So if you had patiently explained how much these quote-unquote illegal immigrants are contributing to our society, then you had a chance. And also to say they're not the problem. Mm-hmm. No. The problem is the corporate greed. Mm-hmm. Totally out of control. Totally out of control. You had a chance of winning over people. So we have our demons. But I don't think, and Trump is playing on that, no question. But and like you say, he's legitimized speaking openly about it. You know, there was a very good book. The author slips my mind. Very worth reading. It came out shortly after World War II. I think maybe like 1947, 48. It was written by a German Jew, a woman. And the book had, the title gave away the book. You know, she was very smart. And when you're very smart, the test of intelligence is to capture complex ideas in simple, lucid language.
Yeah.
And the title of the book was Hostages of Civilization. Mm. She's referring now to the situation of the Jews. And she said the German Jews were hostage to German civilization, meaning 19th century, early 20th century, Germany was by a wide margin regarded as the height, the peak of European civilization. Just to take a homegrown example. So there is W.E.B. Du Bois, the great African-American scholar of the 20th century. He goes to Harvard. But going to Harvard was a deal, but it wasn't a big deal. Mm-hmm. Because then he goes off to study in Germany. When you wanted to be at the peak, you go to Germany, okay? If you take the left, all of Europe, they revered the German Social Democratic Party. That's where all the leading lights were concentrated. And when the, what was called the SPD, Socialist Party, SPD in the German, we call it German Social Democratic Party. Mm. When they spoke, everybody listened and everyone acted. Okay? So, Germany was the peak of civilization. And the author wrote that we were hostages of that civilization because beneath the veneer of civilization, there lurked a lot of ugliness. Mm. There lurked a lot of ugliness. And what Hitler did, he tore off the veneer. And then the German Jews, but obviously others, as well. I don't like to say others as well. German Jews, German working class, many categories of German society suddenly fell victim to the ugly underside of civilization. And that's basically the era we're now entering with Trump, the ripping off of the veneer. So it's a real problem. I can't deny it. And that's why I said I will not counsel anybody who to vote for, because I recognize it's a balancing act. It's not a clear choice. But the Democratic Party, they didn't even want to articulate the choice in a way which was false. There's not a danger, in my opinion. If you take words seriously, this word fascism, there isn't a danger of fascism here. Do you know why? Because there's no opposition. Historically, fascist elements came into power when there was a strong left. The institutions of what we used to call bourgeois democracy were in jeopardy, and the ruling elites acquiesced in a strongman coming into power in order to repress the elements on the left, which posed a real danger to their system. They wanted a socialist society. Some wanted a communist society. All of them rejected the capitalist society. We don't have a left here. So we don't need, if you take, you know, take people in the Supreme Court, people like Justice Roberts. I've studied Roberts because I teach Supreme Court law. Okay, Justice Roberts, Justice Gorsuch, Justice Alito. They love our institutions. They're in love with our Constitution. They love checks and balances. Because the whole purpose of the checks and balances is to make sure the rabble doesn't get out of hand. And also that no elite party dominates another elite party. There has to be an equilibrium among the elites, but always within the context of repressing the rabble. You know, so they love our institutions. Why would they abandon the Supreme Court? Right now they have six justices. They're not going to abandon it. Now Trump has the Senate. He has the House of Representatives. Why do you need a strongman? Why do you need an authoritarian leader? They already, unfortunately, they already control all the institutions. But sorry to have to report this, that's how our bourgeois democracy operates. So this constant threat of Trumpian fascism, I think it's false on two counts. First of all, it's unnecessary because there's no left to fight against. And second of all, they can get everything they want within our system already. They control the Supreme Court, they control the Republican Party, democratically elected. The Supreme Court judges were, justices were constitutionally chosen. So then why do you need fascism? If you understand the term and you're not just using it as an epithet, as people like AOC, who's a certifiable airhead, as they use it, it's totally gratuitous. So I think on those counts, it was a scaremongering. But on the other hand, I have to say that the Trump phenomenon represents the ripping off of the veneer of civilization. There's an adage that goes, hypocrisy is the compliment that vice pays to virtue. You get that? hypocrisy is the complement that vice pays to virtue. Mm. Meaning, you know what you're doing is wrong. That's why you don't admit to what you're saying. You're hypocritical. You don't really believe what you're saying. Why do you do it? Because you know that it's wrong. You're hypocritical because even as you're thinking of vice, you know it's wrong. Mm. You know it goes against virtue. So hypocrisy is the complement that vice pays to virtue. And the thing about the new Trump administration is they don't feel a need to pay that compliment anymore. They don't have to be hypocritical. They're just going to say what they feel. Mm. And that presents a danger. It presents a real problem. Yeah, I recognize that. A lot will depend, I believe, on how certain of our institutions react to it. I think, like our Supreme Court, these are very respectable, reactionary to the core. But certain of them are respectable, and they will recoil at certain of the egregious grossnesses of Trump and may put a check on it. But on the other hand, there is a problem because so much of it has been legitimized. It's been legitimized because of, I hate to say it because everybody's saying it now, and I never like to join in with the choir or speak to the choir, because, and I know people are going to come down hard on me, but I'm saying it within the context, and the context is I'm a person of the left. Because of a lot of the idiocies of the woke politics and the cancel culture and the refusal to acknowledge that maybe the other side has a point. You don't have to agree, but you don't have the right to cancel. And you don't have the right to denigrate everybody who disagrees with you as some sort of reactionary, some sort of hillbilly, some sort of redneck. No, there's grounds for legitimate disagreement. Mm-hmm. Now, people are using that as a club now. If you read the papers, everybody's attacking. On the Democratic side, they're all attacking identity politics, mm-hmm, and blaming identity politics for what happened. No, I don't agree with that. I think the problem was people had nothing on offer that was going to substantively improve their lives. Mm. But on the other hand, the identity politics, the idiocy of it, legitimized the other side. There are legitimate questions about, puberty blockers. Are they a good thing? It seems that the scientific evidence is overwhelmingly no. But the left made that a litmus test. If you didn't support it, you become a reactionary. You become a hillbilly, a redneck, an antediluvian. You couldn't have honest discussion about these issues. So it ended up legitimizing part of the ugliness of the right-wing agenda. I don't believe the whole right-wing agenda is ugly. I think in broad strokes, most of the Trump supporters could have been won over to a left-wing agenda. The core, no. Mm. The core were, there was a fascist core. There is a fascist core, but there is the penumbra as you get further away, and those people could have been won over. Remember, 10% of the people who voted for Obama, 10% of the white working class have voted for Obama than voted for Trump.
Yeah.
So there was room to win these people over. They're not hopeless. You're going to disagree on some things.
Mm. I want to pick on a point that you made about this idea of hypocrisy and virtue.
Mm-hmm.
Because that is the accusation that from the right to the left a lot, which is the idea that you are virtue signaling, that you don't really believe the things that you say that you believe. And we see this in particular, if I can shift our conversation to Gaza and to the year that we have seen under the Biden administration and under a lot of liberal Western leadership. And I don't know if you saw what happened in Amsterdam two days ago.
I saw. I mean, I heard about it.
Yeah.
I read some things about it. I couldn't get an absolutely clear picture of what happened, though I've read some things.
Yeah. So this idea that there were these football-related riots that happened in Amsterdam, mm-hmm. in which fans of the Maccabi Tel Aviv team that was there to play in Amsterdam was attacked by locals. And the story that came out almost immediately was this wide sweeping condemnation on behalf of media institutions and specifically on behalf of world leaders. And this narrative that what happened was a quote unquote pogrom that took place, that targeted people based solely on their identity as Jews. And there was no, at least for the first 24 hours, there seemed to be no space to talk about what it may have or may not have happened on the ground and what its relation could have been to anti-Semitism in Europe. And it felt like it echoed a lot of what we had seen happen in a lot of these Western liberal societies over the last year, certainly in the language of the Biden administration, but also within the language of a lot of European leaders who not only repeated these ideas that this, whatever was happening in Gaza, whatever happened after October 7th, this was uniquely about anti-Semitism and uniquely about preventing a repeat of historical crimes against Jewish people and nothing else. And even a step further, that Europe had now seemingly absolved itself of anti-Semitism and that now the Arab world, the Muslim world, these immigrants that had filled a lot of these European cities that they didn't want to talk about before because it was impolite to talk about immigration. But now that these people were the problem, it's not us, it's these people. How do you see what is happening from that lens? I mean, we can start with Amsterdam. We can start with this idea that something would happen and immediately this very clear line will emerge from it.
Well, I can't speak with authority about Amsterdam because I have to avoid my error of October 7th. When October 7th first happened, I praised without qualification what I thought was a breakout from a concentration camp. So, of course, I'm going to support it. But in the first 2 days, all we were told was that 50 people had been killed. And I thought 50 people, 50 Israelis killed. I didn't know if it was civilians or combatants, but I thought that was a price that, based on the laws of war, was tolerable for people to break out of a concentration camp. It turned out to be more complicated mm-hmm. than I originally thought, and I came under considerable criticism for what I initially said.
That's right.
So I don't want to make that mistake again. I don't really know what happened in Amsterdam. I'm hearing conflicting reports. So I'm going to reserve judgment until I know where. Not because I'm a coward, but because I think I did something. My webmaster, whose name I'm going to name, Sana Qasim, she emailed me like at 3 in the morning or 4 in the morning, and she said, look at the news. So immediately when I looked at the news, I did something I never do. I've never been on social media. Mm. I know nothing about social media. I have no accounts with any social media, none. Not Facebook, not Instagram, not TikTok. I don't even know what these things are.
Yeah.
But I decided, okay, I'm going to show solidarity. And got into a lot of trouble for that. And then I refused to take down what I wrote because I don't believe in doctoring evidence. I said it, and I have to deal with it, and I will address it but I'm not going to destroy it. I don't believe in that. I am an old-fashioned believer in truth, and that's part of the history.
Well, you're an academic. You believe in documentation.
Oh, believe me, most academics, they'll take it down. They'll do everything they can to hide it if they made a mistake. So I don't want to speak to that. I'll just mention a couple of things in this current trashing of identity politics. They're trying to throw in the protests against Gaza. Mm-hmm. And if you read one column today by this venerable Times columnist named Maureen Dowd, she says, when the students were trashing the college campuses and alienating everybody, the Democratic Party was afraid to denounce it. So they're throwing everything into one barrel. There's Latinx, which was completely insane. You know, she was criticizing the term Latinx and was completely lunatic. I mean, what ethnic group wants to sound like a porn site? It's just nuts. And all the evidence showed 98% of Latinos did not like Latinx. And so she calls it, she said it was, you know, a product of the faculty lounge, which is true. But on the question of the Gaza protests, that wasn't true at all. First of all, when I attended, I went to several encampments, not a lot, I don't want to exaggerate, but I went to several. I have keen memories of going to Columbia and going to MIT. One of the questions I asked, because for me it was a crucial question, it was, how are your relations with the student body that's not part of the encampment? Because that will determine whether you will grow, that is, you can bring in new people, or whether you're turning into a cult, us, the enlightened ones in the encampment, versus the unenlightened, the benighted people around you. And everywhere I went, there was consensus that the community as a whole supported them. So a lot of, you know, these are elite schools. They're paying tuitions of $80,000 a year. So they weren't ready to join the encampment. It was a sacrifice, just in terms of getting your work done, you know, papers, you know, these schools are very intense. Yeah. And so they didn't join, but there was a sense of moral solidarity with the encampments. So this idea that these folks were completely alienated from everyone else, it's a complete lie. Mm. What happened? We know exactly what happened. The Jewish supremacist billionaire class went to the board of trustees and said, unless you suppress these encampments, we're withholding our alumni contributions. It was very clear what happened. The sentiment on the college campuses, and then broadly in American society or British society, was broadly supportive of the message from the college encampments and college protests. So it was a flat-out lie what was being said, that these were a minority of a politically correct lunatics. No, that's not what happened. By the end, their message was having a broad resonance, so much so that that's when the Jewish supremacist billionaire class, doing their part for the cause, that's when they started to put the pressure on and committed the most outrageous assault on academic freedom since that concept came into existence in the early part of the 20th century. And not only did they, but they continue. Right now, it is a very scary place on a college campus to utter any words condemning the Israeli genocide, so much so that at places like Columbia University, you cannot use that word in public. You cannot use that word in public. You cannot use Israel and genocide together, or even genocide, if it's implicating without explicitly referring to Israel. You can't use it. But that's not like the lunatic identity politics and the Latin X. It's not the same phenomena. Yeah, a lot of the identity politics alienated, rightfully, a broad portion of the American people. And it was all a trick. It was a ruse by the ruling elites in the Democratic Party. They had abandoned the working class as their base. In my day, which is not your day, the Democratic Party, its entire foundation was the unions. You can't imagine what it was like in our country. The unions, the United Auto Workers, the United Steel Workers, the United Mine Workers, they mean nothing to you, but those were robust, powerful institutions, and they were the mainstay of the Democratic Party. As a large portion of our country became deindustrialized, working class jobs went abroad, union membership, which in my day was about 30%, is now about 9%, mostly public workers. The Democratic Party, because its base had disintegrated, most people, if you ask them, who's the head of United Auto Workers? In my day, we all knew it was Walter Reuther. Who was the head of the AFL-CIO? Everybody knew his name. Nasty guy, really nasty guy. But we knew his name, Walter Meany. You know, we all knew the name. Now nobody knows. Mm. So as the Democratic Party base disintegrated and the party was taken over by corporate elites, they needed a substitute. Who are we going to fill our ranks with? Because every party has a core constituency. And they decide to fill the ranks with this identity politics. And they made that the litmus test of membership. And the identity politics then became, it started to assume a lunatic manifestations, which of course alienated large numbers of people. But that wasn't true with the Palestine question. The Palestine question had a very large resonance among the base of the party, was the elites. Palestine politics didn't alienate the base of the party. It didn't even alienate the people on the college campuses. I mean, I was very careful about observing that. There was, as I said, it was a dynamic between those who committed themselves fully and those who were largely in sympathy but didn't want to participate. The one exception was, you know, the Jewish students, not all, but the Jewish students congregated around what are called the Hillels, which are basically Israel propaganda institutions, recruiting for the Israel cause. So there was they played it to the hilt. We feel afraid. we feel scared by these slogans, you know, like from the river to the sea. We feel afraid. Now, unfortunately, you know who opened that door? You know who opened that door? The identity politics. Because they, before the Jewish students came along, they started to say, if our feelings are hurt, or if this group's feelings are hurt, or this group feels afraid, or this group feels uncomfortable, then the speech should be banned. And I wrote a book. You'll forgive me for plugging it. I never plug anything I write because I don't think people's suffering should be a source of others' profit. But here I will simply state as a factual matter. I wrote a book which is now being reissued called I'll Burn That Bridge When I Get to It.
Great title, by the way.
Yeah. And in it, I have several chapters on academic freedom, freedom of speech. And I also have a separate section on it. And I said, this is not a smart move. Because if I said it word for word, if Palestinians say, we feel uncomfortable when pro-Israel speakers come to campus, I said, it's only a matter of time before pro-Israel students say, we feel uncomfortable with pro-Palestinian speakers coming to campus. And that's exactly what happened. They opened the door to that. You know, in my day, I know I'm rambling, but people should know the history. In my day, do you know what was the main liberal moment in my day? The main liberal moment? It's when the Supreme Court, the state Supreme Court in Illinois, there was a community called Skokie, Illinois. And Skokie, Illinois was the home to many survivors of the Nazi Holocaust. The Nazi Party said in the United States, the Nazi Party is legal, the U.S. Nazi Party. It wanted to march through Skokie. March, en masse. Mm. And the ACLU, the American Civil Liberties Union, the main protector of freedom of speech in our society, or was, the ACLU famously went to court to defend the right of the Nazi Party to march through Skokie. That was the litmus test of being a liberal in my day. The absolute support of not just freedom of speech, but what comes with freedom of speech, freedom of assembly.
And I'm sorry, that's all we have time for today. Check them out on YouTube, Middle East Eye. A great deal of very good information, very solid.